One for a fiver, one for a fiver, two for a tenner. Come on now, sir, and get yourself a bargain. Come down now with this beautiful, real, steel, chrome-plated beauty. You come down here, sir, and get yourself a bargain. Don't miss out. Every day on Oxford Street in central London, where I used to work, tradesmen set up stalls hawking their wares. And an amazing number of people seem to readily part with their cash for these dubious imitations, such as I have here this morning. If they do find fault with the product and return to seek an exchange, they'll almost certainly find that the stallholder has moved off down the street and found a new location. Frauds are commonplace. And this morning we want to see if the resurrection is just such another hoax. Did it actually happen? And if it did happen, what are the consequences for life today? This morning we're going to look through the eyes of one of the people that was first there on the scene with Jesus. And verses 39 to 43 give us a wonderful, wonderful summary of the Christian faith. I love summaries because they save you from having to do the hard work yourself. It's all laid out for you, which is why I've chosen these few verses now. And they tell us a couple of things. First of all, the fact of the resurrection, and then the consequences of the resurrection. On the fact, there is no doubt at all that those who were there at the time believed that Jesus Christ had physically risen from the dead. And that's made quite plain by the use of the word witnesses in verse 39. Witnesses don't operate on hearsay or on rumor. Witnesses see things firsthand, and that is what Peter said that he had done. Verse 39, we are witnesses, and then of three things. First of all, of everything Jesus did in the country of the Jews and in Jerusalem. That is, before we come to the resurrection, we need to see that the resurrection of Jesus happened in the context of a unique life. This isn't just a kind of bolt from the blue that we're being asked to believe in. Jesus had lived this most extraordinary life, full of things that no one else had ever done before we even get to the resurrection. And Peter says, we saw him. We were witnesses of everything he did in the country of the Jews. We saw it with our own eyes. And it's important to understand this. This is not kind of sort of hearsay put together a few hundred years after the event. There were people there who saw the life that Jesus lived. And that's so important for us. This terrible incident with Jesse Ryder. They're looking for witnesses. People who saw what happened. Not who were there a couple of years before, or who'd be there a couple of years after, but who were there on the night that it happened, who saw with their own eyes. Peter says, I am such a person, trust me. We are witnesses of everything he did in the country of the Jews and in Jerusalem. They saw his life. For example, they saw the time that Jesus was there on the street, and there was a funeral procession coming along. And I suppose most of us, if we'd been there, we might have stopped, might have bowed our heads in respect. Jesus looks up, and he sees that at the head of the funeral procession, a lady who's mourning, full of tears. We're told that she was a widow, and she had lost her only son. And then we're told that Jesus, when he saw her, his heart went out to her. It's a lovely phrase. He saw her and had compassion on her. But even if we managed that, that would be the end of our help. We'd just be sympathetic. Jesus actually does something about it. He's got the power to. And so he walks up, he stops the funeral procession, he knocks on the coffin, and he says, young boy, get up. And the lid lifts off the coffin. The young boy sits up. Jesus had raised him from the dead and gave him back to his mother. Now, you've got to be pretty confident before you start doing that kind of thing in public. And Jesus was confident, for he knew he was the Son of God who was able to do it. And it was in public, which is why Peter could say, we are witnesses of everything he did. They witnessed his life. It was a life of extraordinary power, not only raising others from the dead, but being able to calm the storm, you remember, being able to walk on water, being able to feed 5,000 men at one time, being able to heal people who the doctors had not been able to heal. It was a life of extraordinary power. It was a life of breathtaking courage, being able to take on the establishment in the way that he did and never being afraid to do so. It's interesting how it was religious people who always tried to hunt Jesus down. Religious people who in the end put him to death. And Jesus had the courage to take them on. And a life of unparalleled kindness. Who else has lived a life like Jesus of Nazareth? It's such an attractive life, such an amazing life, such a compelling life. And Peter says, we saw that life. We were witnesses of it. But not only witnesses of his life, verse 39, we witnessed his death. They killed him by hanging him on a tree. And Peter is referring here to the events, of course, of Good Friday. There were plenty of people to see it. They saw Jesus arrive at the place of Golgotha, exhausted from the flogging. They saw him being stretched out on a plank of wood. They saw him being nailed to the cross. They saw him on the cross. They saw him die on the cross. They saw the soldiers thrust a spear into his side. They saw him hanging on a tree. And I suppose for most lives on earth, that would be the last that we could say we witnessed of someone. Occasionally we might go to a funeral and we come back and we remark, I've made my farewells. There's nothing else to see. Peter says that Jesus was the exception in human history. Not only did they witness his life, not only did they witness his death, they then witnessed what happened next after his death. Have a look down. Verse 39, they killed him by hanging him on a tree. But God raised him from the dead on the third day and caused him to be seen. He was not seen by all the people, but by witnesses whom God had already chosen, by us who ate and drank with him after he rose from the dead. We learn that God had already chosen a certain number of people to see him, and how kind of God to do so. He did it this way so that no one would miss what had happened. God didn't want it to be done in a corner. He wanted people to witness what he had brought it about. In other words, God wanted to make it as easy as possible for people like us to have an accurate recording of what had happened, so that we might say we knew that Jesus had risen. And I suppose you know how people today say, well, you know, I don't know. I don't think I can believe in a resurrection. I've never seen a resurrection. That is exactly the point. If everyone popped up from the grave, how would you then know who was the Son of God? You wouldn't be able to distinguish him from anyone else. Because one person has risen from the dead, it makes it rather easier to see who in life is the Son of God. And Peter says, we witnessed this person. We witnessed his resurrection from the dead. In fact, in the New Testament, it's littered with accounts of Jesus being seen by different people in different places at different times after the resurrection. In one place in the New Testament, we're told that over 500 people saw him at the same time. And Paul in that place says at the time of writing his letter, in which he says that, he says that some of those have died, but most of them are still alive. In other words, you could go and ask them. You could go and check up with them if you wanted to. Now, Peter here speaks of one specific occasion. We don't know which one of these it was, because there was more than one where Jesus ate and drank with people after he rose from the dead. But it may have been the time when the disciples were locked in the upper room a week after the resurrection of a week after his death. And we're told that they locked the doors because they were afraid that they would be the next ones to be hunted down and to be executed. And suddenly, Jesus is standing among them. And he says to them, peace be with you. We're told that at first they were startled. They thought they saw a ghost. And Jesus, out of his kindness, then ate a piece of fish that was there in front of them, maybe a bit of snapper or a bit of cod or whatever. I assume to show that he was no ghost, but was a real physical person. And also so that after he departed, there would be one less piece of fish than there had been before. In other words, when they turned and looked at each other and thought, goodness, did that really happen? Were we just imagining things? They would know that now on the plate there was only 10 pieces of fish and there had been 11. So they would know that Jesus had literally, physically been risen from the dead. Well, you'll know the story, and you'll know that there was one disciple who was not there at the time, a man called Thomas, and how grateful we can be that he wasn't there. Because when they told him, we've seen the Lord, he said, oh, please,
pull the other one. You know, I'll believe him when I can touch his hands and see the nail marks and put my hand into his side. Then I'll believe. And we would probably think the same. And so a week later, a rerun. There are the disciples, the upper room, doors locked, Thomas with them this time. And who should come and stand among them but the risen Jesus, who turns to Thomas and says, "See my hands? Put your hand into my side. Now believe." And Thomas knows when he's defeated. And he falls on the ground and says, "My Lord and my God." In other words, he had now come to believe. And the reason he'd come to believe was because he had seen with his own eyes. And this is the testimony that we are given for our benefit, so that we who have not seen might now be able to see through the eyes of one who had seen, Thomas, and be able to believe. In other words, there were witnesses who were there. And these people were not people who were kind of desperate to believe. They weren't hanging out to believe in the resurrection. They weren't expecting to see the risen Jesus. This wasn't some kind of wish fulfillment. These were people who had dismissed all hope of Jesus' promises being fulfilled. They had rejected any prospect of seeing God's Messiah again. And now, contrary to their expectation, they saw him. So the resurrection of Jesus, it wasn't done in a corner. And how kind of God to make it as easy as possible for people like us in the 21st century to be able to believe in it. Now, I have to say that not infrequently I come across people who never really look closely at the evidence for the resurrection, and they are surprised when they do so. And I remember this because when I was 19 or 20, not a Christian, and beginning to look into these things, I was amazed at how compelling the historical evidence is. At the very least, we can say there were four clear facts. First of all, Jesus definitely died. Secondly, Jesus was definitely buried. Thirdly, the tomb was definitely empty. And fourthly, Jesus was definitely seen. And you know how in life they say that the right explanation is usually the most obvious one? Well, to me, when you've got those four dots, how do you join them up in any other way? And I remember myself coming to the point in my life of realizing it was really taking more faith not to believe in the resurrection than it was to admit that I believe that Jesus has been raised from the dead. But even if it is true, what are the consequences? Because truth be told, it is very possible to believe that Jesus rose from the dead and not to become a Christian. You don't have to become a Christian just because you believe Jesus rose from the dead. That is a rather different question. And so I want us to come on to the consequences that come from this. For example, does this mean that Christianity is a good thing for those who happen to believe in it? A bit like a hobby, you know, an interest. Such and such goes to the tennis club, and such enjoys rugby, and so goes to the bridge club, and so else, they just happen to go to church. They happen to be into that kind of thing. Or is there something more compelling that we should draw from this? And I think this is important for us, because we're all busy people. The plate is already full, perhaps overflowing. And it's going to take a radical shift for us to empty the plate and have something else come on at the centre of it. And I want to put to you in these last few moments now, as we look at verses 42 and 43, that just such a rationale, a compelling rationale, is given for us to make Jesus the centre of our lives from now on. Two consequences are outlined for us that flow from the resurrection of Jesus. First, there is a judge. Verse 42, have a look down. "Jesus commanded us," says Peter, "to preach to the people and to testify that he is the one whom God has appointed as judge of the living and the dead." You need just a line on the Old Testament to understand this. Back in the Old Testament, that is the first two-thirds of the Bible, before Jesus came, God made a string of promises that one day he would send his king to earth, a king who would rule forever and who would judge the whole world. And he said, "You will know this king when he comes because he will be raised from the dead," which is partly what that first reading was talking about in Psalm 110. And so when Jesus is raised from the dead, here is the evidence that is needed. I suppose it's like those kind of photo fits. You know how in the paper you get a picture of someone, sort of photo fit. This is the person we're looking for in order to arrest them. So that when you see the person on the street, you can say, oh, goodness, link. There's the person, arrest them. With Jesus, it's not so dissimilar, I should say. With the Bible, it's not dissimilar. The Old Testament is the photo fit. It says this is what to look for when God's king and judge comes to earth. It is the resurrection of a man. Over here, Jesus is raised from the dead. You don't need the brains of a scientist to be able to link the two. He must, therefore, be the king and judge that God had always promised. And that immediately makes this of rather great consequence. We're told, verse 42, he is the judge of the living and the dead. That includes everyone. And if it includes everyone, it must include you and me. And therefore, the resurrection of Jesus is a very important position in respect to us. To many people, of course, it never occurs to them that there would be any problem entering heaven. They imagine that all you have to do is to lead a moderately good life, and the gates of heaven will just swing in, as if God is a heavenly kind of Father Christmas. You know, ho, 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 my standards are very, very low, and everyone come in. But in fact, it doesn't really work like that, because before coming in, we have an appointment. It's an appointment we can't avoid. It's an appointment we can't delay. It's an appointment we can't be late for. It is an appointment with a judge who knows us better than we know ourselves. And I imagine this, only in my own imagination, but I imagine it's rather like being in a huge stadium, perhaps an Olympic-sized stadium, with all of us there, every person in history with their own seat. And one by one, Jesus Christ will call out names. He'll be seated on the throne down in the middle. And one by one, people will go down and stand in front of him. And at some point, Rob, Kay, Joan, Fred, your name will be called out, and mine too. What? And we'll walk down and stand in front of them, in front of him. And when we stand in front of him, he will see our whole life before him. Not just everything we've done, he will hear everything we've said. With his X-ray eyes, he will look into our minds and see every thought that we have ever thought. He will weigh the motives of our hearts. We will be stripped bare before him. He will see us not as we pretend to be when we put our best foot forward. He will see us as we really are. Now, I don't know about you, but if you were in a room with someone and you know that they could read your thoughts, everything you were thinking, I don't know what you would do. I know what I would do, which would be to get out of that room as quickly as possible. But on this day, there will be no running. Running won't be an option. Each of us individually will stand there. We won't be able to hide behind a spouse or behind our parents or our children or Christian friends. Each one of us will stand there by ourselves. The resurrection of Jesus shows that he is the judge that God has appointed. And speaking for myself, that puts a certain amount of fear into me. What will it be like? You see, you can keep on putting off Jesus year after year after year, but you can't put him off forever. Here is the appointment we cannot miss. It's a frightening prospect for all those who are guilty before God, like each one of us. But then the apostle finishes off with wonderful news in verse 43, which is the second consequence of the resurrection. First, there is a judge. Secondly, there is forgiveness. Have a look down verse 43. All the prophets testify about him, that everyone who believes in him receives forgiveness of sins through his name. Forgiveness is what we need. And forgiveness, wonderfully, is what he is offering. Forgiveness means that God is prepared to wipe away everything we've ever, ever done wrong, and everything we will do wrong, to take it away from us. And we're told in verse 43 that everyone who believes in him receives this forgiveness. We need to know that this isn't a case of the judge going soft. This isn't a case of Jesus showing mercy at the expense of justice. But rather, this is the consequence of Good Friday, where Jesus died for our sins. For when he died, The judge was himself being judged. He was judged at the cross, taking upon himself the wrath of God, so that criminals like us, those who have committed crimes against God in God's world, that we might go free. In other words, the one who was innocent became guilty, so that the guilty might become innocent. And we read here that it is because of the resurrection that everyone who believes in him receives forgiveness of sins through his name. When I was at school, occasionally someone would disappear from the school. Not, I have to say, in sinister circumstances, but they would have committed some crime or other and were sent home for a period of time. The most notable of which was my own friend Edward Eva, who one night in his brilliance set fire to part of the school, and one wing of the main building went up in flames. And Edward Eva thereafter disappeared for a period of time. Now, when such a person then reappeared at the school, it was obvious that their sentence had been served. You see? The sentence had been paid. The debt had been paid. They reappeared. They were integrated into normal life, or as normal life as you could allow someone like Edward Eva. Now, here it is not so dissimilar that at Good Friday Jesus dies and then disappears from normal life. He lies in the tomb. And on Easter Day, when he returns and bursts back into this world, he does so to give us the assurance that his sentence has paid. I say his sentence, that our sentence has been paid, the sentence for our sins. He is reintegrated into normal life, but this time different. For he has been raised from the dead to have a body that will never perish. So that whereas we're on the slide permanently now from year 21 onwards, it's just a battle to try and keep things north and stop them going south. Jesus has a body that will last forever to show that one day he will be able to raise us from the dead, that we will have bodies which will last forever in the new creation. And in verse 43, we are being told that he is offering us the forgiveness of sins because he has paid the penalty for us. Maybe up until now, you didn't know that forgiveness was needed. But now you do, with the image of standing before Jesus. Maybe up until now, you didn't know that forgiveness was on offer. But now you do, for there is one who has died and has risen from life to bring this forgiveness and to offer it to us. Here is the most precious gift a person can be given. He is offering us something. And something that I have to say is a good deal more attractive than another lump of chocolate. The judge is offering for our sins to be cancelled, literally cancelled, that we might be reconciled to God, put in the right with God, made right with him forevermore, able to stand before him. And who does this gift come to? Verse 43. To those who live a really good life, all the prophets testify about him, that everyone who lives a wonderful life receives forgiveness of sins. That's what most people believe. Oh, you just try hard enough in life and then he'll let you in. But it doesn't work like that. Is it to those who have been very devout in their church going, who are very sincere? All the prophets testify about him. That everyone know who believes in him. That is, who entrust themselves to him, to Jesus, who hands over their life to him. And of course, maybe that's the rub of it, because that is what we find so hard to do. To entrust ourselves, holus bolus, to someone else. All that we are, everything that we have, is such a hard thing. It doesn't come naturally. We are independent people. We are individual people. But maybe most of all, we are proud people. We don't like the thought of having to vacate the driver's seat and to hand over the steering wheel of our lives to someone else. But I think this is simply a case of knowing in the end when you are beaten in life, of coming to the understanding of when it is you can't win. Truth be told, you can have a great life in this life and not be a Christian. You can have a marvelous time for 70 or 80 years, although sometimes it's not so marvelous, but often you can. Because God's so kind, he gives us all the good things we enjoy. But here is the problem. that Jesus stands in our road. He stands in our path, and we won't be able to get around him. We have an appointment we cannot miss with him. We can try and push on with life without him, but in the end, we will not be able to win against him. I mean, how strong do you think you are? Do you think you can beat the Lord of the world who has risen from the dead? We are on a losing wicket against him. And so the common sense thing to do is to bow before him and to accept the forgiveness which he offers us free. And I just want to encourage you, therefore, this Easter time to take this opportunity to seriously, to take Jesus seriously, and not just to put him off for another day, another week, another month, another year. Yes, the plate is full. So many things to do in life. But I suggest we would be better pushing those off the plate altogether, if only it means putting onto the plate, at the centre, the one person who really matters, the person who holds the key to our eternal future. On the bookstall at the back, I see lots of free copies of this little book here, Is Jesus Alive Today? It's really a copy of John's Gospel, which gives an account of Jesus' life from one of the people who lived life with him, the Apostle John. A first start for you today might be to take one of these and to read it for yourself. No one's going to come after you. No one's going to hunt you down. Here is an opportunity for you to do a bit of data gathering so that you might be able to make an informed decision on which to base your future. And I put it to you that a few hours invested in reading now, you might look back on as the best investment you ever made. Thanks for listening.